Matthew. Matthew's gospel is the first in the Codex W. And the first page of Matthew's gospel is the first page of that book. And so it suffered a little bit of decay and disruption. So you have to work around the edges a little bit. Last week I gave you a copy of the first page of the Vatican manuscript and asked you to go through and find the names there. I hope some of you did that. It's a good exercise, and it's kind of a puzzle. It's an interesting game. You can see who can do it the fastest. But it teaches you the correspondence of the Greek and American or English alphabets. And so that's helpful. Did some of you do it? I've heard already that some of you did. Did any of you find the name that got changed before or it reached the Vaticanus manuscript, and so it's wrong in Vaticanus? Did any of you figure out which word it was, which name was wrong? I hear some discussion back there. Did any of you figure it out? There's one name there that they just got wrong. Now, it wasn't wrong in Codex W, okay? It wasn't wrong in the inspired version, but the copies. You know, that's a problem that I don't want to leave you with the impression that the Bible is so riddled with transcription and the translation errors that it's unreliable. Most of these things are pretty trivial. The one we're talking about today is kind of revealing in a way, and there are several things about this first page that scholars simply looked over it and didn't study it. Just like you, when you read the Bible, you come to Matthew 1, you skip down to halfway through the first chapter because it's just a bunch of names, right? And what am I going to learn from that? So there's a tendency, and it apparently was a tendency with Mr. Sanders, who also was one of the early reviewers of the material. He just simply didn't notice some of the things that are there. Pardon me? Yeah, human nature doesn't change. That was 100 years ago, and it's still the same, isn't it? Okay. So, this is interesting how Matthew begins his gospel. I remind you that these images that we see of the Codex W and Alexandricus and so on, those all come from this one website, and you can go look at this yourself. In Plano, Texas, there's an institution that is for the study of New Testament manuscripts, and you can look at all of them. It's made for scholars to go look at, but you could be a scholar just like everybody else. Maybe you don't read Greek, and some of them do, but remind you what Peter said. He said, what we wrote down as the Gospels are based on what? Eyewitness accounts. Do you ever wonder why the news on Channel 13 is called Eyewitness News? Apparently, if an eyewitness reports something, it's not secondhand information. Now, he or she may be deceived about what they thought they saw, but nonetheless, that's kind of important in news, isn't it? And this is the news. This is good news in the first century. And so it was important to Peter and everybody else to make it clear they didn't make this up. Cleverly invented stories. No, that's not what we're talking about, but that's what the skeptic thinks about it. And when you talk to someone like that, then you have to deal with their opinions about matters here. And they need evidence. They want to see something, hard evidence that it isn't the way that they think it is. All right, here are the first pages. Matthew's first pages. Notice the one on the left is a little darker than the one on the right. The one, the left and middle images are of the first page front and back. And then the third page on the right, the third page on the right has these striations in the vellum. You can see it throughout. Those are tiny blood vessels in the membrane of the goat that from which they made the vellum or parchment on which it is written. And you don't see those in this page. That's because that page is sheepskin vellum, sheepskin parchment. And they use them both in making Codex Debian and other codices as well. And so you can tell which it was. And it's an interesting question about why this is different from that. Henry Sanders noticed that, and he recorded it in his reports, but he didn't interpret it particularly. Now, if you go look at how this is assembled into a choir, the choirs of Matthew are all made out of goatskin vellum. And if you go looking over here where the other half of this page, which is folded around these, comes up, you find that this is just a single page that was appended to the front of the Gospel of Matthew. That tells us something. So here apparently is how it was put on. We have a choir of four double pages or eight pages front and back that makes 16 pages of Scripture. And then this one page, think of them as pointing away from you here. This one page is folded on the edge and attached in with all of the other folded edges here to make the first choir, the first gathering of pages. And there's several of them in Matthew. And so instead of there being 16 pages, there's 18 pages to the first choir because this additional sheepskin vellum was attached to the rest of it. It could have been, if it was too small, it could have just simply been glued to the edge of the next page, but that's not a very stable way to make a book, and so it's thought that there was at least a small fold on the edge where it was attached. I'll remind you about the alphabet. You had that in your handout last week, and you have to watch, for those of you who may not have been in here before, we have to watch particularly to about certain letters. There are some letters that don't occur in our alphabet, psi and phi. L looks strange. L and A and D are both housetops, as you see here. It depends upon where this crossbar is as to whether it's an A or a D. And if there is no crossbar, it's an L. These manuscripts are all capital letters. There aren't any lowercase. And the letter C is used for an S. And what looks to us as a P is really an R. And the pi symbol that we're kind of familiar with is the letter P. And the letter O occurs in two forms, as an O, the way we think of it, and as omega. The capital omega in modern Greek looks like an upside-down horseshoe, but they weren't using that at the time. They were using this rounded W for an O. And the letter H is the other one we have to worry about because it uses a vowel. When it is, it's like a short E, an A sound. Like we do sometimes in our language, we make the H silent, and it has a vowel sound to it. And then there's the letter chi. The X is really what they used as a hard C in the Greek language. So there are some differences, and you kind of have to be aware of those when we go to looking at all of these names. and what they call noma sacra, names that are sacred, sacred names. God, Christ, Jesus, Lord, those are abbreviated in these documents. And you wonder, well, why in the world would they do that? Well, it was a Jewish tradition not to write those names out. And the Septuagint is the same way, the Old Testament translated into Greek. And so they were, I suppose the scribes were somewhat afraid to write the whole name out, because if they misused it, there was a prohibition of misusing the Lord's name in vain. So anyway, that's what they did, and that helps us, because when you look for, when you see two letters, or in some cases three, with a line above them, that you know what that is, and you only have two letters to deal with, and so Jesus Christ is an I, U. Oh, and the letter capital letter U looks to us like a Y, but an I U. Chi U is Jesus Christ. So you can find those in your material. Okay, now this first page, at the top, we have the title, and it's kind of lost in the decay up here. It's the gospel after Kata, and then it's Matthew over here. And then there was some decay on this corner, so we missed a word or two up here. But once we get down here, you can read all of the words. And it starts out, the biblio, that is the book of the genealogy of, here's Jesus Christ, son of Abraham, son of David, son of Abraham. And here's Abraham's name right here. And so I ask you to take the... Here's the translation at the bottom, incidentally. Book of the generation of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. Abraham begat Isaac. Isaac begat Jacob. Jacob begat Judah and his brothers. And so that repetitive system of presenting this material all the way through that first part of the first page led to one interesting mistake. We don't have time to talk about it, but one name was left out. And by looking at the genealogies in the Old Testament, you can figure who it was that was omitted, because there's supposed to be 14 names, he explains at the end, 14 names in three groups of people, from Abraham down to David, and from David down to the captivity in Babylon, and from there down to Jesus Christ, should be 14 names in each group. But in the middle group, there's only 13 names. And it appears that one of the kings was omitted because of the repetition. The copier who made this particular copy, he wasn't used to doing that sort of thing, and I suspect he just overlooked a name. It doesn't change anything. We know who it was that was omitted, because he's missing from the genealogy. But do any of you know whose name was omitted? Just at the time of the Babylonian captivity, one of the last kings in that list, let's see, who was it? Now, I brought all that up and cornered myself here because I can't remember who it was. Jeconiah is listed as the last one, and the one who went just before him was who? Well, you'll have to go look in 2 Kings to figure that out. But anyway, that I said I wasn't going to dwell on that, and here I am dwelling on it. So anyway, but that's a negligible thing, because it doesn't change anything, except it doesn't make it turn out to be 14 in each group. So. But that wasn't what we were concerned about. Question is, why was this page pasted onto the front of Matthew's gospel? And you get the impression then that Matthew had probably written his gospel in in Aramaic, say, or maybe even in Hebrew. And he had the story figured out from the end of the birth narratives all the way through to the end, but he didn't have a good way to start it. And what he decided he wanted to do was to put the genealogy of Jesus at the start. That was important because it showed that Jesus fulfilled the predictions in the Old Testament that it would be a descendant of David who would rule on the throne forever. And obviously that's the Messiah, yes. No, it's. I'm going to show you that. I'm going to show you that in just a minute. So anyway, here we have how it begins. And I gave you this information on the left side and asked for you to go through and look at those names. And some of you have done that. I know that that's the case. And if you haven't, it's an interesting little puzzle just to go through and find those names. What I have done is take Codex W and do the same thing. I'll show it to you in just a moment. So here's how it looks. You can see on the right at the beginning up there, the lettering is much clearer than it is in Codex W. This is the Vatican version, and so you can make out where these letters are a little bit. To me, the difference looks to be primitive, and the other is a little bit more commercial, if you will. They've had much more experience in writing over here than in that case. So here you have clear writing. All right, I've already pointed out the difference in the sheepskin and goatskin. Now here are the names in Matthew. And I put a box around all of them so that you can see them. And you've been down all this list. It goes down through all of these names. And Jehoiakim is the one that's omitted down here. He was a king just before the Babylonian captivity. I couldn't think of his name, Jehoiakim. So you have all of these names, but there's one name that is wrong in some of the manuscripts that presumably were copied from this. Here is the Sinaiticus, I'm sorry. And you'll see this name right here. You come down here, here's Ezekiah, and he had a son named Manasseh. And Manasseh had a son named Amos. That's Amos. That was wrong. It should be Amon, right? And you remember, Amon is labeled as one of the most wicked kings of Judah. He was really a bad idolater, and was labeled that way. And so maybe as a punishment, that God had him misspell his name. I don't know if it has anything to do with it, but interestingly. The Vaticanus that you looked at has that same mistake. Instead of an N, there's a C right here. A C represents the letter S, and so the name turns out to be Amos. Who was Amos? He's a prophet in the Old Testament, isn't he? That's clearly not what was intended. Curiously, Amon? Yeah, could be. He was certainly an idolater. I don't know where his name came from. But anyway, both the Vaticanus and the Sinaiticus have this change to Amos instead of Amon. Well, where'd that come from? Well, you know, that isn't the case for the Alexandricus because the first two-thirds of Matthew's missing. And so we don't know, we can't look there to see if it was correct or not. But the Septuagint, when you go back to Second Kings and read the story in the Septuagint. In the Septuagint, it's Fourth Kings. But anyway, when you look at the story of Hezekiah and Manasseh and Amon, it comes out as Amos. And I think a scribe went through here and said, that's wrong, because obviously in the Septuagint, it's Amos. That ought to be Amos. And they changed it because they couldn't read the Hebrew. And you remember I said they were going through and changing I's to E's and things like that, correcting the spelling. This is several hundred years after Christ, and the Greek language had changed a little bit, and so they were trying to keep it up to date. Well, somebody noticed that Amon was there, and they thought, no, that's not right, because in the Septuagint, it's Amos, so they changed it. The change was wrong. I don't think it makes any difference, but it gives us some clues about some things, because it was correct in the Codex W. Okay, so here's the rest of it. Now, he lists all these names down to Jacob, and then Joseph, and then Mary's name is here, right here. Joseph's name's over here. It's I Omega S E and Phi, which serves as an F. They don't have a J, so they do I O for names that we translate as Joseph and John and Jacob and Jerry and any other name in there that occurs. So that, I want you to notice how that is spelled. We have the correct spelling here. And then he goes on. Well, you've seen that. Well, where am I going here? Let me back up. Okay. Now we have an interesting problem at the start of the genealogy, in that it appears where this circle is up here that there was a scraping. You can see the striation marks. And a name was erased. The book of the generation of somebody became the book of the generation of Jesus Christ. Then you begin to ask, well, where did this material come from? And whose name was there before Jesus' name was put in? Two clues are here. That is that all of this writing at the beginning is in a dark black ink. But what is put in here, the I is left, and then the U and the Chi and the U and the line above them are drawn with an ink which is not as strong, not as black as the rest of it. And so when they did that, they changed it from a general genealogy from some other person to that of Jesus Christ. Now, does that sound fair? Can they do that? And where did this list come from? Apparently, a scribe took the official genealogy of some individual and made a copy of it, okay? You can ask, where did he get the original genealogy in the first place? Did he go knock on the door of the temple or go visit a priest or somebody? The Jews are not going to give the Christians any information if they don't have to, in my opinion. This belonged to somebody who was already a Christian. And the choices there among the major players would be one of the apostles or someone associated with Jesus. Huh? That's a good guess, and I'll show you that. Right above it here, I have put Joseph's name. It began with an I, Omega S-E-F. And you can even see right here the old part of the F, and right here is the C that corresponds to that. I think this belonged to Joseph. Originally, who would have, now Joseph is dead, long gone, who would have a copy of Joseph's genealogy. And it ends with Joseph, you might remember, plus a tagline that explained that Mary was, he was the husband of Mary who bore or gave birth to Jesus, who is called the Christ. It's very careful wording at the end there. It does not imply that Joseph was the father of Jesus, like all of the rest of these do, but it clearly implies he was the husband of Mary, and it was Mary who gave birth to the Christ. All right, here's where that change occurs, where the arrow is, and I don't know that it shows up real well here, but down to here, the ink is pretty dark, down to this line. And let's see how that looks. He begat Joseph, the husband of Mary, to whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ. So, down to there, the ink is darker than it is the rest of the way. And I think that, but the writing is the same. I mean, the hand that wrote this is the same as the hand that wrote this. You can go look at all of the letters and they're the same. You can tell when a scribe is different, when the scribe changes in the text because of the handwriting, which is slightly different. They were pretty uniform in Codex W, but you can pick these out. So here is, it's the same scribe. He copied all of that off. Then he copied all of this off, and here he's talking about the birth of Jesus. This is what they call the birth narrative. So now that makes an interesting puzzle, doesn't it? Joseph's name at the start would suggest that the genealogy down to the point where it begins to mention Mary and the birth of Jesus was a standard genealogy. It was probably a legal document. It may have had a seal on it. It may have had writing on it that made it official. And somebody kept Joseph's official document. Who would do that? Who's still alive? It would be Mary. And she was the one that we'll show next week. We'll talk about Mary being interviewed by Luke. And she traveled a lot in her old age. She lived to be in her 80s, and apparently so, because she was at least 15 or 16 when Jesus was born. And by the time he was 30, she was 45 or 46. And then 10 years later, she's in her 50s, 60s. And so she lived, and the history tells us that she lived a long time. I think she kept that document. Why would Joseph need a document like this? Say again? Well, that would be one thing. But Joseph needed this document. I'll show you in a minute. In those days, Caesar Augustus decreed what? A census. Remember that? This is in Luke. Taken of the entire Roman world, and everyone went up to his own town to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth and Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and line of David. He went there to register with Mary, and it goes on talking about that and the birth. Do you suppose he needed any legal documentation when he went to register? Or do they just take his word for it that he's a descendant of David? See, I think this was his documentation that he took at the birth of Jesus to show that he was, after all it says, the record of the lineage of Joseph, the son of David, that's who's mentioned first, and then the son of Abraham, that shows he was a Jew. And that's all that it says. Now, the other cases, introductory and other ways, where Jesus' lineage is talked about, it talks about he was the son of God, but not in this one. And so I think this may have been, that's a guess on my part, and it doesn't have any bearing on our conclusion. But you wonder, well, how did it happen this way? I think Mary kept that document. Now, the tagline that was put onto it that said, Joseph, the husband of Mary, to whom Jesus was born, Jesus, to Christ. That tagline and this document would have given her free entry into any Christian community in the world, don't you know? If they said, who's this little old lady who just showed up? Well, somebody could claim to be Jesus' mother, but she had the documentation to show it. And so she didn't want to give the documentation up, but she let the scribe copy it. See what I'm saying? That's why he had a piece of vellum and he copied the thing down to the middle of the backside of the first page. And then he took it right up there and talked about analyzing how many generations from Abraham to David, from David to the captivity, from the captivity to the birth of Jesus. And he goes right on with the story about the birth of Jesus. He puts it on the same page, but in a slightly lighter ink, which suggests the copying of the document took place probably wherever Mary was living. He brought it to On in Egypt, and he started there, and he said, well, wait a minute, this says Joseph, let's change that to Jesus. So they erased Joseph and put Jesus at the start. Then it fit exactly, and they went right on with the first page of the Gospel of Matthew. Added that on and went on to the second, third page of the choir and went right on through with the story that, translating perhaps as they went, or perhaps it had been translated before, and that they were adding that on to the material that came from this document. So that's an interesting analysis of it. Now, there have been, Lee Woodard made some guesses about where the document came from. It's clear, though, that the document was added to the first page of the gospel, was tied in. It's not a separate page, you see. He went ahead and put the gospel story on the backside below the genealogy, went right into the second page without any connections there. It was a continuation of the story in his view. And Matthew, as we pointed out before, put his seal at the end of it, suggesting that he approved of it as it came out. Now, if it had been added to Matthew's account as a separate page that didn't have continuity with the rest of the story, you would suggest that it might have been added later. But the fact that it goes right on with the birth account and puts that in the consecutive pages that follow it suggests that it was part of the document that Matthew approved at the end. Now, whether or not it was Joseph's genealogy doesn't matter. It just makes sense that it could well have been, because I think he really needed one when he went to register in Bethlehem. So we have these conclusions, and the conclusions are pretty simple. A standard genealogy was brought to the scriptorium and used as a starting point for Matthew's gospel. It wasn't the starting point of Matthew's Aramaic account before it was translated. It was blended in with the translation that came later, I think. We don't know who did the translation. Matthew may well have been capable of it, because what was his business? He was a tax collector. He was used to business dealings. He was used to records and that sort of thing. So he probably spoke Greek. Whether or not the translation is his, we don't know. But it was done under his supervision, and he put his seal at the end of it. It was on sheepskin vellum and was attached to the first choir of the goatskin vellum. And if you look further on into the middle of it, you don't find the other half of that page as sheepskin vellum among goatskin vellums. This is just only the very first page. The name Jesus Christ was inserted in the place of an earlier name in verse 1, and it doesn't matter whose name that was or where it came from, but it does make reasonable sense that it was someone else who was associated with the Christian movement. I'm not supposed to say that. With the church. I heard what he said this morning. Yeah. someone else who was a Christian. And so a document like that wouldn't be easy to find. I think when you think about it, and to have one that was maybe 50 years old, that had kept carefully. And Mary evidently kept a lot of stuff. You get that impression talking with her, and we're going to talk about that next week when we talk about Luke's gospel, because he did some interviewing, and she knew who had said what and explained everything to him. Okay, all other existing manuscripts of Matthew. Now, that says there may be manuscripts that are gone or that haven't been discovered. But among all of those that have been, and there are, when you get a little bit further down the road into the 600 and 700s A.D., and you've got a lot of upper, lowercase. Remember, we talked about the minuscule manuscripts. There are thousands of manuscripts. Ultimately, they all include the genealogy, as far as I know, without exception. So it is likely an original source document. See why? Because it is added to the front of it. And so that is a strong argument from the standpoint, not so much from the standpoint of the writing as it is from the structure of the book and the organization of the material, the addition of the story at the end of the copy, that it isn't the original manuscript. It isn't the original document, excuse me. But it was extended to make it a part of the original document of the gospel. Okay, any questions about that? I surprised myself by getting through a little bit early today. Did any of you have any trouble with the reading of the names and the homework? I think you can do that. And if you say, well, I can't read Greek, I think you ought to give it a try, because you can pick those names out because it is repetitive. And so, you know, there's a name here, the Father, and then the Son, and then the Son is put at the head of the next line, and his Son. And so every name's there twice. You can follow through there, and if it isn't clear in one place, it would be clear in the other. And so it's possible to go through there and see that listing. And the fact that there was a name left out, apparently, that has puzzled scholars for a long time. There's supposed to be 52 names in that list, 3 times 14, and there's only 51. And what's missing is in that middle section of 14 names where there's only 13. Now, it's easy for a scribe and coming through, repeating the same phrase again and again. We looked at that. It's translated begat in the King James Version, but of course it's a much longer line of type for the Greek. And so he goes through and he writes that, and then he says, okay, now what's the next name? And it's the Son of the Father that started that line of type. And so he puts that in, and then he repeats that name as the Father of the next one. And if he gets mixed up in the middle of one of those transcriptions and skips a name, he actually puts the Father on one line and the grandson at the end of it. It's an easy mistake to make. And we're going to see a mistake like that in the Gospel of John, where there is a repetitive statement. It becomes a trap for the scribe. The Jewish scribes, by counting the number of letters and the number of words and what's the center word and what's the central letter in a section of material, they were able to see when they had left something out. I doubt if the Greek scribes were that careful, and it appears that they weren't. So can we trust what we read here in Greek? How does that get sorted out? Well, there was a man named Nestle, and his cohort named Allen. The two of them set out over about 150 years ago to look at all of the manuscripts of the Bible, Old and New Testament too. It took them years to go through and compare the different manuscripts. They arranged the manuscripts into families, and that where there was an error like we've been talking about, and put them all together in groups like that, and tried to decide which family led to which next family, to the next family, to look at the generation of the language. And doing so, they decided which parts of it had been copied in error. It leads us to the clear understanding that copying was not inspired the way the original language was. And so they sorted all of that out, and all of the modern translations that you have came from the work of Nestle and Allend. Nestle's German, but they were excellent Greek scholars. And if you get a Greek, English, interlinear New Testament, you'll find footnotes that say, okay, this didn't appear in some of the earlier manuscripts, or this is some other scholar's opinion about what it ought to say. All of those details in 99% of the cases are minor things about translation. And it doesn't change the Bible as we have it. In fact, we can thank him for sorting out a whole large number of copyist errors like that. And all of the modern translations come from his work. And so I think you can trust what you have in English as a very reliable translation from the original. But it helps if we have the original, right? And the point of our lesson in this class is to say we do have an original gospel. We have four original gospels in Codex Debian. I'm going to give you, each week we're going to talk about more evidence that it is reliable, that it did come from the hands of the authors. Now that's a very, very strong statement to say something like that. But the scholars who work on these manuscripts conclude sometimes they don't want it to be all cut and dried, of course. They have scholarship to support things that they've, opinions they've written in the past. They don't want to be shown that they were wrong. But anyway, they don't always, they're not always trustworthy. But if we have original autographs, as we appear to have in Codex Debian, that is very important information and very powerful information to convince somebody that the gospel records are eyewitness accounts. That's what we're about in this class. And there's something about each of them that lends credence to that conclusion. And we'll talk about Luke next week. Time's up. Thank you.